Hello, everybody. Welcome to Dots on a Map. This is episode 5. We're going to talk about JVs and RJs, kind of comparing the two business models and what can we learn from the top side of our scope and the bottom side of our scope in Section 1 of the Pilot Working Agreement. I'm Captain Brent Allen, an Atlanta-based A320 pilot, and I've got with me today, returning to the pod for the second time, Captain Chris Hazelton. He's a New York 320 captain and the chairman of our strategic planning committee. In the last episode, I had Evan Bach on from the communication committee, and he has experience fairly recently from the DCI feeder side of the house. And we talked a lot about the history of RJs at Delta and kind of covered the bottom end scope, the flying that we allow Delta Connection carriers to provide under the Delta Code. What are the lessons that we can draw from our experiences with the RJ stuff in the past, and is there anything that we can apply to the top end scope stuff that we talk about with our joint ventures and ownership stakes and our international partners? Let's talk about what we can compare between RJs and JVs and you know, maybe some of the comparisons that don't work as well. If you're listening here and you have access to the dalscope.org website, you can go on that website and you can download not only the pod, but we're posting talking points for each episode from now on. If you want to follow along with some bulletized information that kind of follows what we talk about in the pod, you can do that. It may help follow our conversation. If you like that, let us know. If you don't like it, let us know. Send us your questions and your comments on the pod. For the talking points for episode 5, we want to make 3 primary comparisons between RJs or DCI feeder carriers and Delta's current business practice of joint ventures internationally. Number 1, it's outsourcing of pilot jobs. Number 2, Delta gets exposure, both good and potentially bad, with our JVs, just like RJs. And then finally, we'll talk about labor relations between partner entities, and that's something that history can teach us a lesson about that as well. First off, we'll jump right into one of the more controversial claims. Joint ventures and Delta Connection carriers are both methods of outsourcing Delta pilot jobs because we're carrying Delta-coded passengers on non-Delta metal. There's reasons we do both on the feeder carrier side and international JV side, but why it's outsourcing and why maybe we need to do that or do we need to do that? What do you think about outsourcing Delta pilot jobs via JV, Chris?
Yeah, well, to reiterate, the RJ model and industry is similar but also different from the joint venture threat that we're seeing now. Brief history, you look at our contract, Section 1 outlines the scope and starts with the notion that all Delta flying will be done by Delta pilots, and then a series of essentially carve-outs or allocations allow certain flying to be done by other carriers. A whole section of smaller jets, less than 76 seats and so on, are allowed for the connection carriers. And then joint ventures are handled kind of one-on-one with some basic protections when we enter into a joint venture. So while they're similar in nature in that, yeah, Delta passengers are flying on other metal, so to speak, the RJ model has somewhat diminished as a threat to our careers, our jobs. And the joint venture model is still evolving. We're entering into new joint ventures almost on a monthly basis, it seems, and the world is kind of evolving in an economic model where that makes the company feels that makes more sense. So they are similar, but they're different in that RJ model is almost primarily in domestic markets or near domestic markets. Joint ventures are almost primarily in international markets, Aeromexico being the closest one, but most of them being across oceans and into different territories, governments that present new challenges.
In the RJ podcast, we talked about large RJ flying as a mainline product, you know, on those, you know, Delta's even invested in new RJ aircraft with the CRJ-900, and the atmosphere cabin is something that popped up on DeltaNet. It was talked about in investor-type communications, Motley Fool, other outlets out there talking about RJs. And with the limited number of RJs that are currently allowed via our pilot working agreement. Right now, we kind of have that source of non-Delta pilot flying. It's kind of fit into a box when you think about it. There's a limit on how much they can do. And that limit on airframes and how large those airframes are allowed to be makes it a very finite amount that we can kind of calculate how many pilots it would take to do that. And so what we did in the last pod was we talked about if we were to do all the large RJ flying at Delta, it would add about 2,300 pilots to our seniority list, and that's a very conservative estimate. That's using a mix of how smaller carriers staff their airplanes and then the model of how Delta staffs their airplanes. So that's an easy number to come up with because you know there's X amount of airplanes, and we're going to staff it at this ratio, and we get roughly 2,300 pilots that we could add if we did that flying. When I initially came up with the idea of this particular podcast, I thought, well, how can we define how many Delta pilots it would take to do all of that flying? It's a little more difficult to do that because the suppositions you have to make are very broad. Rather than come up with a number, what we've done on the talking points is provide some data that just illustrates how much flying that we do, and we've just taken just transatlantic as a snapshot. Because it's easy to see how many aircraft our partner carriers across the Atlantic have, and we're focusing on wide bodies and how kind of we measure our balance across the Atlantic within the existing JV, and then we'll talk about some of the numbers that we got from EF&A.
Right. Well, first to identify our transatlantic partners are currently Air France, KLM, Virgin Atlantic, and Alitalia to a certain extent. That's evolving into a new transatlantic joint venture, which will be formed a partnership between Air France, KLM, Virgin Atlantic, and ourselves. There is, as we talked about in the previous podcast, some cross equity where all the partners kind of own a share of everybody else. They make network. Their goal is to make network decisions and kind of work as one entity with antitrust. So, given that our partners right now, Air France, KLM, Virgin Atlantic, have about 184 wide-body aircraft. So not all of them do transatlantic flying. Some go east from Europe into Asia and so forth. But to give you kind of an idea of the size of their operation, it's about 184 wide-body aircraft.
And that, so that's 184, that's all the wide-bodies, and this is all from airfleets.net, or it's public stuff. So the numbers may be off by one or two, but we're talking about the wide-body airframes, non-cargo, at Air France, KLM, and Virgin Atlantic.
That's correct. And we kind of measure our production balance, if you will, versus them, and the company does as well, and they have a commercial agreement with their joint venture pilots, partners. They measure that on different metrics, but essentially the equivalent air seat kilometers, which takes into account the size of the aircraft and how far it goes as to determine the split of the balance. Some of that flying, like I say, we measure that as well in our pilot working agreement using EASKs or EASKs, as they'll be called, to determine that we're getting our fair share of the flying going forward.
Those of you out there listening to the pod, if you listen to our first episode, we talk about why we use EASKs. It allows an apples-to-apples comparison between dissimilar airframes. So it allows you to compare a 757 to an A380 and come up with a metric where you can compare the two of them flying per block hour. And it also takes into account belly cargo carried. We know right now in the current transatlantic joint venture between us and Air France, KLM, and Alitalia, we have a 46.5% floor of the EASKs carried over the Atlantic or bundle one flying. If we take just Air France, KLM, Virgin Atlantic, and Delta, and we do a new measurement, how is that split right now?
Well, roughly right now, we do the split between our partners, Air France, KLM, and Virgin Atlantic. If you lump them together, we do about 40% of the EASKs versus the 60% of all those entities put together. And that's been more or less a steady state for the last 7 or 8 years, give or take a couple of percentage points. But that's roughly the split that we're looking at.
And if we were to divide it among the carriers, it would be roughly 40% Delta, 40% Air France KLM, and 20% Virgin Atlantic. Is that right?
That's correct, based on EASKs across the Atlantic, what we call the Bundle One flying.
We can look at basically how much of the current look-back flying Delta does. And I had our folks at Alpa National EF&A pull some hub-to-hub transatlantic departures to see essentially how much of that flying the Delta pilots do right now. The table is attached to the talking points. So essentially, we took a look at flying between Amsterdam, Paris, and London, and the Delta hubs of Atlanta, Cincy, Detroit, JFK, LA, Mini, Seattle, and Salt Lake City. And if you look at all of those via departures and block hours, the numbers are very similar. It's essentially Delta flies about 55% of the total departures and block hours between our three primary European destination hubs and the Delta hubs in the U.S. And that means our partner carriers all together fly about 45% of that flying. If we're going to, you know, create an alternate universe where Delta does all that flying, we have to also acknowledge that there would be a lot of capital expenditure, a lot of bleeding, a lot of non-profitable flying over a period of time where we plant our flag and try to win that market share in a foreign country. And we know from history that we haven't always been successful when we've attempted to do that. So we acknowledged earlier in earlier episodes that the value that we get in a JV is that we get access to customers in another country through their carrier without having to bleed to get it. The price for doing that is that we share that revenue. We've acknowledged in the past that the JV model of expansion, while it certainly has some things that may concern us on a jobs number, it does have value in a business model, right, Chris? Joint ventures and Delta Connection, I mean, what parallels can we draw? They're both methods of outsourcing flying that is sold under the Delta Code. I think there's no way to get around that. However, where we can draw a very clear distinction in the DCI feeder role that, hey, that is flying that we could easily perform because it's all domestic and it's done on smaller airplanes, but Delta does it for business reasons because it's cheaper to get that feeder flying accomplished by outsourcing it. It's not as clear. You can't make a direct comparison between that model and the JV because what we're getting in the JV model in exchange for us not having all of the flying, we get profitable access that we may not otherwise have in the JV. So we can agree that there are methods of outsourcing, but I can't draw a specific number of jobs that we would have if we didn't do any JVs. We can't say that we would have X amount of more pilots on the seniority list there. But we have the data on there that shows kind of what the balance is, and that's what we try to capture when we enter into these JV production balances with the company in negotiations. Is we try to capture through the look back and establish a floor on what we will allow to be outsourced while trying to insert some type of metric in there that guarantees equitable growth in the future. The second point is Delta gets exposure to these markets, exposure to more customers. And a point that I'd like to make is we're exposed just like call it a marriage. You're exposed to all the great things that your partner brings to the table. You're also exposed to maybe some of the not as great things. Can you talk about some of the good stuff that they bring to the table there that we're exposed to?
Yeah, absolutely. When Delta's able to sell tickets or essentially capture passengers from different markets using a joint venture brand, it's been clearly shown that in those markets, passengers have a clear preference of the local brand, if you will. A French passenger getting on somewhere in a smaller city in France has a natural preference to buy a ticket through Air France, even if it ends up being flown on a Delta airplane. Likewise, there's a preference for Americans to buy tickets through a known brand such as Delta, even if they end up going on a French airplane, an Air France airplane, just as an example. That carries through just about in every joint venture. Aeromexico, we're exposed to markets down there where they're familiar with the Aeromexico brand. They have the marketing, they have the familiarity, they have the traditional cultures. So we get that benefit of essentially capturing those passengers who might not otherwise know of the Delta brand worldwide.
Delta corporate rhetoric, the stuff that we see in investor relations, currently Delta demands a revenue premium over our primary competition. That's all very tightly controlled and promoted via our culture within Delta, and the Delta pilots are part of, of making all that happen. There are certain markets, Virgin Atlantic actually commands a premium over what we can sell a ticket for because they're kind of like a boutique brand, right? They have their own little, they have their vibe that has been promoted by Branson and all of his brands that some people find very attractive. That's a positive, right?
Yeah, of course. The our partners that have their own brand recognition, their own markets, we certainly bring that to the table. Of course, the flip side of that is long-term stakeholders. Pilots typically have longer careers, 20, 30-year careers. The natural inherent concern is that you have a brand dilution that somewhere down the just with the RJs, having passengers think or kind of inherently believe that traveling on an RJ is essentially traveling on Delta. We still have that same concern traveling on our joint venture partners, that somehow is translated as to being part of the Delta identity, right, in the brand.
Right, so Delta canceled my flight, Delta missed my connection, Delta lost my bag. Those are all things that we do very well at Delta Mainline. We get exposure to the good things. We also get exposure to some uncertainties of being partnered with international carriers. European carriers have different labor laws. We have to acknowledge that while we are exposing ourselves to their customers, we're also exposing our customers to the good things and the vagaries of a carrier that we may not be able to control 100%. The last thing I'd like to bring up in the pod, JVs and DCI are, they're outsourcing. We're exposed to their operation. And labor relations between these entities is crucial. The RJ Defense Coalition actually sued ALPA. They didn't think that the mainline pilots could dictate to their airline the scope requirements. So the suit was essentially filed because the DCI carriers at the time, this was back in 06, 07, 08, they wanted to fly larger aircraft and still fly it under the parent company brand. And mainline pilots set a line in the sand with 76 seats and 86,000 pound takeoff weight. That is a past labor versus labor situation. We had pilots basically fighting pilots. In the current situation with JVs, we know that we have international labor groups. We've gone to great lengths, especially in the Delta MEC, to reach out and cultivate relationships with those other labor groups. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's an extremely important facet of our strategy going forward and our expressing our concerns. The parallel with the connection carriers is much different than it was 10 years ago, obviously. A large part of that's been alleviated with the natural progression of the industry, where the movement up through the regional carriers for a lot of pilots is become much more rapid. It's not as stagnant as it was, so the friction that existed between the two groups, us and our connection carriers, has largely been diminished in that role. In the international arena with our joint venture partners, we have a strong relationship, especially with the long-term joint venture partners through our Sky Team Pilots Alliance, the SPA, if you will. We have two meetings a year. That's an important component so that we have an open dialogue and essentially a phone line to any of our joint venture partners around the world.
Yeah, I think it's a great point you make that while we can look 10, 15 years ago and see that the relations on the DCI side between labor was probably at a low point because of financial pressures in the industry, that it's a lot better now. Cultivating the relationships with our partner carriers now can alleviate any pressure that may come up in the future to disincentivize offloading of Delta passengers because of disparate cost basis. See, that's something we'll get into in the next episode. We're going to talk about those labor-to-labor relationships we have via the International Affairs and Alliances Committee. But Chris, I want to thank you for coming on again. Always very informative. You got anything you'd like to add?
No, thanks for having me, Brent. I'm always happy to stop by.
Awesome. Well, thanks, guys, for tuning in. Please stay tuned. Look at dalscope.org, or you can go to the MEC website and look at the scope compliance and analysis subpage on there to get the data that we're talking about, to download the talking points, and to click on a link and send us an email. If you have any questions, we'll be happy to answer those on the pod. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you guys next time.